This is your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane and famous Exxon gasolines. The wake-up call is also brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. Now your host, Rick Moore.
Hello, everybody. How's it going today? It's party time at the wake-up call. That's right. It's a beautiful Sunday morning from here in the downtown studio on Old Ivy Road all the way out to our friends in Lovingston at 94.7. And you know who's helping bring this together? Do you know? Besides myself, it's 45fix.com. If you have a home improvement project, there is another way to find a contractor. It's 45fix.com. From remodeling to repair projects, immediate, no obligation estimates are available anytime. That's 45fix.com, the number 4, the number 5, and the word fix.com. And aside from 45fix.com, there are other folks out there today, and they're helping us put together this program, which I think many of you will find interesting. You know, all I did to put this together was roam the website of the University of Virginia, and I stumbled across something called the Institute for Practical Ethics and Public Life. Very entertaining. And through that, I found a couple guests who were willing, obviously haven't listened to the show before because they were willing to come onto the program. Let's see if we have the mixer and the Mackie board working this week. Professor Ruth Gar Bernheim, is that correct?
Yes.
Oh, I think I heard something out of that difficult board. Ruth, try one more time.
I'm here.
Yes, we can hear you. Okay. Oh, it's like life from outer space.
Good morning.
Good morning to you as well. Ruth Gar Bernheim, I have executive director here. Is that correct?
Associate director. We all work together.
You all work together, so no one steps on someone else. Yeah. That's nice. It's always like that. I like that better. Unfortunately, here, I always get stepped on by Ann Williams, who just finished up the Bluegrass show. I don't know why she feels that way. Ruth Gar Bernheim from the Institute for Practical Ethics and Public Life. And you have a longer title. Share that with us, because people who've earned those titles should at least get one opportunity to toss them out.
Well, my other role at the university is on the faculty in the School of Medicine in the Department of Public Health Sciences, where we have a lot of educational programs for undergrads and a master's graduate level program. That includes opportunities for medical students and students from around the grounds to look at public health. And we at the university, tying us back to the Institute, integrate ethics into these programs. So one of our core missions is to have an education that it in every sphere asks students and faculty to pull back and think about what are the ethical tensions and values that are part of our education and are part of our public life.
Thank you so much. We also have Professor Jim Childress on today. Jim, I have as director for the Institute of Practical Ethics and Public Life, and fairly recently received the university's highest honor, the Thomas Jefferson Award. Is all this correct, Professor?
So far, yes.
So far. Oh, you have more to go.
No, that's fine.
No, that's fine. And your official title, it was so long, it was like a right. paragraph, but I'll give you an opportunity to shout that out.
Hollingsworth Professor of Ethics, holding a chair endowed by one of our donors, a supporter of the Institute.
Well, I'm very glad to have both of you on today. Thank you so much for taking time out on what is a beautiful Sunday.
Our pleasure.
All right. For those who, we're taking some time to shout out the ethics part of things, what really caught my attention is practical ethics. I think for many people, practical ethics, aren't all ethics meant to be practical? So let's take some time here to talk about the difference between ethics and morals and give them the definition and what makes them practical and things like that. And then we're going to get into some very interesting, illustrations of how this all works. So who wants to start by defining ethics and talking about the difference between ethics and morals?
Those terms, ethics and morals, or morality, are often used interchangeably. And I think we have to keep in mind what Aristotle suggested, that we can only expect the precision appropriate to the subject matter. So we're going to have to recognize there's some fuzzy boundaries here. But for the way we think about ethics, it's ethics as reflection on morality. So it's stepping back and asking, all right, so what sorts of things are good or bad or right or wrong? And how can we go about defending and also understanding and applying those? And so when we're talking about practical ethics or applied ethics, what we're thinking about is real-life problems in practice, in professional life, in public life, as well as personal life. When people have to make hard decisions about what to do, then how do they think about and how should they think about the relevant principles and values as they reach a decision? Now, we prefer the term, and again, practical and applied are often used interchangeably. We have a slight preference for practical because often applied suggests that all you have to do is get a theory right, an ethical theory right, and then simply apply it to the factual circumstances.
All right, you know, you got to remember, I haven't been in college in, 3 or 4 weeks. So you really, so think differently about speaking to me at the seminar or from the professor's, you know, lecture area, and make it for the dumb guy that you're having milk with. because I need the simple definition for ethics and morals. What is, tell me what an ethic is.
I started out by saying that the boundaries are fuzzy, and I think if one is thinking about, yes, all of us have ethics and often quite simple views of what we believe to be right or wrong. What we're looking at is the way in which in complex life, political, public, professional life, there are often difficult questions about what to do that will bring into play a range of values. Our reflection on that is what we're talking about in terms of ethics. It's asking hard questions about how do we reason ethically? How do we try to determine what would be the best course of action, all things considered, when some of our important values come into conflict?
And does that mean that
a great example in the Washington
morals
Post?
Morals are what decision we made?
No, morals often, and morality will often actually refer to practice, to what people do and how they think about those matters. Ethics is often used to think about or to step back and say, let's think about those. Let's probe the presuppositions and implications. So it's a reflective activity. Now, again, you'll find that the uses quite mixed, and we're suggesting one that is quite common and that we think is defensible, and it's one that, for purposes of this discussion, characterizes what we're about. That is to say, we're trying as an institute to help facilitate this reflection on basic ethical principles and values and how they relate to real-life problems. If you saw the Washington Post this morning, there was an interesting example. The addictions counselor who encountered Dr. Ivins of the anthrax case, who committed suicide several days ago, she had to make a very difficult decision about whether to break confidentiality and to report him to the authorities. Well, that's the kind of question that will arise in real life in different professional settings, and people have to make a decision about which value should have priority. Now, what we do in ethics is, all right, let's think about those values. What are they? How do you defend them? What do they mean? And how do you deal with the conflicts, whether in public health, issues that Ruth addresses in quarantine, isolation, surveillance, allocation, or that I've tried to address some in organ transplantation, or that our colleague Andy Wicks tries to address in business. So what we're trying in all those areas to think through is how best to reach ethical decisions about difficult matters.
And I might jump in here just to add that it isn't just about professional and public policy issues of great significance, but when we talk with students in our classes and integrate ethics into our classes, we can talk about it in much more simple terms that all of us face day to day. So, for instance, we will do a class with athletes about some of the tensions, the ethical pulls that arise when they're in playing athletics in the sports field, or, you know, when we all sort of go through our daily activities. And so to make the distinction you were going through in that context, we often say, well, morality is something common to all of us in society. We walk around sort of with understandings of what is the right thing to do, or what isn't the right thing to do in a lot of situations. It's, morality is like a language in some ways. It exists. And the distinction we try to make with ethics with our students is to say, let's pull back and think about, reflect about, in any given situation, what is the right thing to do? Because ethics for all of us is all things considered. What should we do here? What is the right thing to do when we're facing these tensions in everyday life or in professional life? And so we make the distinction about, of course, there is morality that we all grow up understanding, when we shouldn't lie and, you know, common things. But then when we go into everyday life, we have tensions. And so ethics is about pulling back and reflecting on what are the values, what are the tensions, and how can we sort of think through it as individuals or together in organizations or in our professional lives.
All right, we are talking about ethics, practical ethics. Practical ethics and public life, that really caught my attention. The Institute for Practical Ethics and Public Life here at the university. Professor Jim Childress, Ruth Gare Bernheim, here in the studio today. And, you know, the phone number, I'm sure you're going to want to call up and ask a question at some point during our hour, 979-0919, 1-877-WNRN Rocks, or maybe you're sitting at the computer listening online, WNRN Studio, if you want to catch us because you're listening through the online method. And let's thank Blue Ridge Graphics for allowing us to put this show together. You can find them at Meade Avenue and East High Street, serving Charlottesville with custom T-shirts, sportswear, and professional graphic design since 1979. That's Blue Ridge Graphics, 296-9746, and at brgtshirts.com. All right, 11:12 on the wake-up call with our wonderful professors in the studio. You know, and either one of you can jump on this and answer. I think to the average person, you know, ethics and morals are tied together. And Professor Childress, you've adjusted that thought here for us. But isn't it just black and white in the sense of, if I have good ethics, then I have good morals, then I'm a good person and I'm going to heaven, or whichever religion you have? And it's just that cut and dried.
Well, for many people, it may be. However, most discover that, as a matter of fact, when they're dealing with complicated questions, not only in their personal lives, family lives, but also and especially in professional and public settings, there will be conflicts of values and conflicts of principles, and then they have to make the hard choices about which one to give priority. Certainly, one of the big questions of ethics, and when Andy Wicks calls in later this morning, we'll talk. He'll talk a bit about that. Would be, how do you get people to live up to the principles they affirm, which may be based on religion or something else? But as a matter of fact, even good people may have difficulty discerning the right course of action in particular circumstances. They encounter conflicts or dilemmas that they have to try to think through and resolve.
And those are what we call the gray areas.
The gray areas, yes. The gray areas where the principles and values do come into conflict. So you can make an argument on either side of a particular action, but finally someone has to act, and that may involve compromising some principle or value. So we think about many of our principles. There are absolutes. There are clearly absolutes that we all affirm in terms of prohibition of a murder or rape or cruelty, for example. But then for many of our other principles, such as ones Ruth mentioned about being truthful or keeping promises and not harming others, there will be settings in which it may be impossible to realize all those values simultaneously, where we have to sacrifice one for another.
The little white lie? Is that what we're talking about here?
It could be. It could be the little white lie. And then the difficult question, of course, is, ethically speaking, when is it really justifiable Or when are we simply saying, well, in this particular set of circumstances, you know, it's in our best interest to do something? Because there are situations where people are simply ignoring or trying to rationalize a breach of moral principles. But in other situations, there may be genuine conflict. So that, and the examples I used earlier about, well, when do you, for example, put someone, restrict someone's liberty in the public health context in order to protect public health because a person is a threat to others because of infectious disease? Or should we as a society allow people to buy and sell organs? Or should we, at a particular point, be willing to stretch the truth in order to protect some other important value?
Well, let's talk about that. You mentioned the health issues because, Ruth, that is your specialty area.
Well, let me just add, it is Jim's specialty area as well, so we will both address
these issues. So you can both comment on that. Okay. Not that I want to leave someone out, but I want to make sure that everyone gets to talk as well.
Sure.
That's Ruth Gare Bernheim trying to shave me off here. all right. Because one of the things that, as we exchanged a little email, ways to increase the supply of organs for transplantation and supply for donation. How do we do that? I mean, how does that apply? How does that comment or statement apply in the term of ethics?
We face a very difficult situation, if I might start Ruth. We face a very difficult situation. There are over 99,000 people on the waiting list for an organ transplant.
And this show has done that organ donation with, I don't know if it's Life, but whatever the local
Life,
program
Life Net,
is.
Or Life, yeah.
But we've had those folks on several times. So regular listeners and myself are familiar with this being a severe problem.
And we had 28,000 organ transplants in 07. That's a huge gap. We are using a donation system. Should we change to a market, or should we presume consent if people haven't said no, as some countries in Europe do? And now the only way one can think about those...
All right, back up for a minute. The current U.S. method of doing things is... you have to check, yes, I'm willing to donate on my driver's license or some other format.
Or if you've not done that, that is, if you've not said no, if you've not checked no, then your family may make a decision after your death. So
but typically you have to say, I'm willing to do so, and if you haven't said that, it is presumed that you don't want to do that.
No, typically then the family makes the decision. And most of the decisions about organ donation in the U.S. are made by families.
Really?
Not by individuals signing donor cards. But we can then work it two ways. We could try to increase the number of individuals saying yes, or we could try to increase the number of families saying yes if individuals have not said no. But some would say, well, the way we'll get people to do that is let's add money. Let's provide money to individuals to get them to provide their organs after their deaths. Or let's pay families. And in each case, there's a conflict with other important values. It may be a way to increase the supply of organs, but it may also run afoul of other principles and values, including putting a burden, for example, if we're talking about living sellers of kidneys, and individual could sell a kidney and still be able to function fairly normally in most cases. If we allow that, how are we changing the way we think about bodies and parts? Are we exploiting the poor and underprivileged? That is, are we running afoul of principles of justice? Are people really able to give a voluntary consent in these settings? And finally, would it really be effective? Those are questions of ethics. So we take a view of ethics as a very broad one that asks, what are the values at stake in a particular situation or policy, and how can we go about addressing those?
All right, it's 11:19 here on the Wake Up Calls. We are talking about ethics with two professors from the Institute for Practical Ethics and Public Life here at the University of Virginia. Let me take a moment and give you the Markets of Tiger Fuel weather forecast for Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Partly sunny with isolated thunderstorms today. Highs 80 to 85. A little chillier in the valley and a little warmer in Richmond. Partly cloudy with isolated thunderstorms tonight. Lows 55 to 60. And again, chillier in the valley and warmer in Richmond. Then mostly sunny tomorrow, highs 80 to 85. right now in the Valley, 77, 80 in Lynchburg, 84 in Richmond, 79 in Charlottesville on a beautiful day.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call, brought to you by The Hook and by the Markets of Tiger Fuel, a refreshing pause on your journey to anywhere with locations all over town. Now back to your host, Rick Moore.
All right, let's thank Blue Ridge Mountain Sports for their support of the Wake Up Call. They have everything you need to get outside this summer. The professional staff at your nearby local Blue Ridge Mountain Sports can help you with camping supplies, maps, guides, and even guided backpacking trips. Blue Ridge Mountain Sports can be found in the Barracks Road Shopping Center here in Charlottesville and at the Mountain Inn at Wintergreen. Okay, Ruth Garrett Bernheim and Jim Childress here as we talk about ethics and what are practical ethics. Now, Ruth, we were talking about organ donation, etc. Now, one of the first things that comes to mind as Professor Childress is talking about money is that old wives' tale about somebody being found, you know, waking up in the bathtub covered in ice and to find out that one of their kidneys has been taken from them so that, you know, some black market can sell the kidney. Is that part of the ethical concern for this? Is that becomes a true story rather than just some old wives' tale?
That's certainly part of the story, but sort of the peripheral part of the story. What we try to do with ethics and public policy and the question of organs and the question of allocation of resources in general is a larger question about how we together reflect on what are the important values to help us set up good systems. So whether it And the process is about reflecting on what are the tensions and what are the values at stake in a particular context. So whether it's each of us individually or professionals or whether we as society collectively doing the process, it is the same. It is to say, let's pull back, look at this particular question. You're raising the one about organs and saying, okay, how do we sort out all of these values and these tensions? So, of course, we have on the one hand individual interests and liberty interests in property. And some people tend to think of body as property, and that's one way of conceptualizing it. And on the other hand, we have the pull of the community, our collective values, and we have obligation in some sense, a responsibility as individuals and together as individuals, as a public, as a population, to make sure we use the community's resources for the benefit of all of us. So look what we have then in organs. We have, as in most public policy questions, we have the pull of individual interests and moral claims, and we have the pull of the population as a whole. How can we create policies and systems that benefit all of us? Well, we all have a stake in that as well. So that's a tension. So what do we do about this tension? We're pulled in both directions, right? Now, one of the problems with the market and concerns that one raises with the market is if we value the individual interest greatly, and we have a presumption in our society to value individual interest and liberty, well, one of the things that can happen is that people can be abused or there's a harm that arises from that because people sell, there's a money at stake, and people can then be harmed. So when we do our big balancing as a society to say, should we value liberty interests here of individuals, or should we try to spread the resources and create a system for the good of all, what are the tensions here? One of the issues we'll look at is, what are the harms that could come to individuals if we set up a system that has a market? And, you know, that's why context is important. We have to look at the big context and see what happens. Well, we know black markets from cigarettes and alcohol happen. That's part of the context of social life, right? So we have to weigh in that potential harm when we think about the advantages of focusing on liberty interests and letting that trump sort of other important values, such as making sure everyone has equal access to the organ pool.
And I think Ruth did a great job in explicating key issues, and I think that's illustrative of the kind of thing we try to do at the Institute. Sometimes we do take particular stands and say, argue strongly for one thing or the other. Often our task, though, is different. It is to step back and try to identify what's at stake in a particular debate, to clarify the issues as much as we can, to stimulate the imagination of the stakeholders, and then to try to move to some resolution in terms of professional matters, for example, conflicts of interest, or in terms of public policies such as the one we're talking about in organ transplantation.
Quick question, because one of our other guests is on the phone, but have any changes in the format of the way we do things come from discussion at the Institute?
We have been involved as individuals in a number of policy activities and professional activities. I personally participated in, as vice chair of the Federal Task Force on Organ Transplantation, that the report of which was very influential in developing policies regarding the allocation of organs. Ruth has been involved in discussions at the Centers for Disease Control and so forth. Often it's hard to point to particular individual contributions, but our participation in the conversation and discussion in the deliberation about policies and our effort to facilitate those, we believe has had some impact, but it's often difficult to judge impact.
And part of the impact, I think, is the process that we and the discussions and the deliberations we participate in. So whether any one thing that we said had an impact, one can never measure, and one would never even want to think about that in things in that way. The point is to participate and deliberate together about looking for red flags. What are some of the tensions we might not even be seeing, and what are the harms that may happen, and to be able to pull back together and reason about them. So when we're trying to figure out in any situation in our personal or professional life or in public policy, what is the right thing to do here? We're pulled in a couple directions. There's tension between our belief in liberty for individuals and our belief that everybody should have a fair shot at something. So lots of times liberty and equality, these pulls that we and values that we all walk around with, a lot of times those are in tension. Well, how do we pull back and think about right now in this context, in our personal life or in U.S. policy right now, how do we weight the different values? All things considered in this context, what should we do? And so that kind of reflection, and whether it's in our own heads or with our family, or as Jim and I have just been talking about with organs or public health, whether you do it with professionals or the community at large, that deliberation and conversation and getting them going is, I think, how we measure our impact. How many conversations and deliberations have we gotten started? And I think we've developed a number of programs where we've at least sort of gotten things riled up a little bit in some areas.
And have helped to train students to move into these areas. That's been one of our big contributions. We have 20 students this summer who are doing ethics internships in public policy, in public health, in professional organizations. And so, as you well know, and not only is it difficult to measure along the lines Ruth indicated, but also the impact through, in this indirect way, through the education of students.
Yeah, and let me just jump in, because this could be a seg. I know Andy Wicks is going to be calling in. We are sort of trying to develop internships and educational programs that Jim just said that prepare students to think throughout their lifetime, to give them frameworks to think. So we have a course that brings together, and I do it with Andy, which is why I'm introducing this idea now, where we bring together business students, law students, and medical students. And we say, let's read these books, this literature, and think together about what the moral tensions are that you see in this book or this film. And how, for the rest of your life, can you start thinking about these? Because, as Andy will probably help us think about, in the business world, there are good people who have found themselves caught in terrible situations where they've done things that they regret. Well, why? And so what we're trying to do at the Institute is start people on this road of of thinking about and seeing the ethical tensions that they see have in their lives now and that they're likely to see throughout their professional life, no matter what they do, and say, okay, I'm supposed to pull back here. I feel some red flags. I feel some moral tensions. How can I think through this as I did back at UVA?
All right. We do have Andy Wicks on the phone. Let me do this before we bring him up to join us for the hour. As we are talking about practical ethics and public life, Jim Childress, Ruth Garr-Bernheim from that UVA Institute, we want to thank organizations like Alt Energy for allowing us to be on the air. Alt Energy providing professional design and installation of solar energy systems in Central Virginia and the Shenandoah Valley. Alt Energy solar systems can pay for themselves and reduce your carbon footprint. More can be found at AltEnergyIncorporated.com. All right, on the phone line, we have Andrew Wicks. Let me fire him up. Professor, are you there?
I am, yes.
Oh, so sweet. I love the sound. And Jim and Ruth, you can both hear Andy. All right, thanks. All right, and Professor Andrew Wicks, with applied ethics at the Darden School, and I guess the first joke many people would make is, are there any over there? Because, you know, I want to jump into that right away, is many people have lost faith in business, have they not? They seem to think all people...
It's not the first time I've heard that joke. I hear
well,
that all
and
time.
I'm sure. but I think that many people have lost faith in the average business, not just big business, but average business. And there's going to be a delay here because Professor Wicks is listening online.
Yeah, there's no question. And there have been some studies recently done, surveys that suggest that public trust in business is quite low. But I guess what's also interesting to note is while we focus on that in this era of scandals, where all these horrible things that have been happening are still very fresh in our minds, if you go back, public trust in business has been low for at least the last 30 years. Before that, we don't really have as good a data. But you look at places like Gallup, and the numbers have sat pretty consistently at 20%. They've slightly gone up and slightly gone down. One of the interesting things, though, to think about that is the disconnect between people's general attitudes towards business and when you talk to them more about businesses that they have direct day-to-day interaction with, the place they go buy their groceries from, the place where they go buy their gas, the bank that they work with. Oftentimes they have much greater confidence and trust in those institutions, but business in general, absolutely not. But it's something that business executives are also very interested in. There was a survey that was recently done of business executives, and public trust, public faith in business, was by far the most important question on their mind. So it's something that they are aware of and think is extremely important.
I'm curious, Professor, this is Professor Andrew Wicks, Olson Center for Applied Ethics at the Darden School here in the University of Virginia, joining us on the show today. Is there a flashpoint for this, something particular that happened that began the downward fall of positive thoughts in business?
Well, I think if you go back historically, we've had a number of things. We're very conflicted as a society. On the one hand, I think we as a country represent one of the strongest supporters of the ideals of capitalism, the idea of the freedom of the individual, the celebration of private property, the ability for people to go out and pull themselves up by their own efforts. That's on the one side that would seem that we would openly embrace markets and business. On the other hand, we have longstanding tensions and things that would make us less supportive of capitalism. And that goes back to our Christian tradition, the Christian tradition, and again, concerns about things like usury and this image of business people as basically fundamentally evil. And these two tensions exist in how we think about business. And again, when we get to circumstances where companies like Enron are doing the things that they did, WorldCom, it just exacerbates those underlying feelings.
One of the things that I heard on the news this week is that someone purchased the Elvis Presley Peacock outfit for $300,000.
Wow.
In this particular economic time frame. And you've mentioned the business setting and how that works from the ethical standpoint. I'm curious as to whether there are individual economic ethics where you can look at someone who does that, spends their money in that way, when so many people are switching to riding a bus to work or buying ramen noodles for their dinner with the family. You know, this memorabilia.
Yeah.
And so many people can't afford the gasoline or the food and having to change things. You know, does that fit into what we're talking about?
Oh, certainly. I think we as individuals, as well as a society, have to ask some hard questions about how we use our resources. But I think there are also some traps that we can fall into in terms of thinking that wealthy individuals or corporations have obligations to solve all the world's problems. And that's where we get into a lot of really rich conversations about what it is that corporations and what it is that wealthy individuals owe back to society and how far those obligations extend.
What are the rich conversations?
Well, I think there's a lot of them, but one that I've been very interested in is really trying to better understand why it is that decent people do awful things. And again, a lot of people have talked about Enron, and I think if we peel back most of the cases we'd look at to talk about places where people have done just awful things, nobody would disagree that what happened was wrong. The question becomes, why did that happen? And what do we think of the people who were involved in what happened? And if you look at Enron, we can certainly point to a couple of people who we might want to say were bad people. But if you look carefully at what happened, it involved the participation and the cooperation of a lot of people, hundreds of people, across many different organizations. And the question is, why did they go along with what happened? And this takes us back to a set of experiments that were done at Yale University back in the 1960s by Stanley Milgram. And I want to emphasize that this is not unique to business. We're talking about examples of misconduct in business. What interested Milgram in this phenomenon was what happened in World War II Germany, the creation of concentration camps. And if you look at the world right now, what's happening in Africa, what's happening all over the world, there are forms of systematic cruelty and brutality happening all over the place. So it's not just about business. Milgram conducted a set of experiments that looked at, he was telling the participants, it was a study on memory learning. How well do people learn under conditions of stress? And he wanted to see how far people would go in implementing shocks, which were the source of tension in these experiments that would supposedly help people learn. Basically, if you were asked a question and you got it right, you'd simply go on to the next question. But every time you answered a question incorrectly, you were punished, and you were punished with an electric shock. The question in the experiment was, how far would the average person go in shocking someone else in this experimental scenario? Now, the person who's being shocked is not actually being shocked, but they're giving answers that are very convincing, as though, you know, they're crying out in pain, and as the shock levels go up, they're crying out louder and louder. The shocks that are being implemented are being done by the experimental subject. They're levers on an electric shock box that go everywhere from 15 volts all the way up to 450 volts. And they not only had these number indicators, but they had verbal indicators above them. Mild shock, moderate shock, severe shock, danger, and at 450 volts, it was XXX. At 150 volts, the person who's being shocked complains of a heart condition and says they want to get out of the experiment, and at this point, they're already making loud protests when they get shocked. The protests continue to get louder and harder, and by the time you get to 330 volts, the person stops having any response at all when they're shocked. So they're either unconscious or they're dead. They don't answer the question, and when they're shocked, they don't make any response at all. And the question they asked is, how far would the average person go? They asked a group of psychologists, where do you think the average person would stop? And they said the average person would stop at 150 volts, and that fewer than one person in 1,000 would go all the way to the end at 450 volts. And in the experiment I just described, over 50% of the people that participated went all the way to the end. They basically killed another person for no reason with no incentive. And we think this film is so provocative, we show it to all of our MBA students who come through. Because it suggests that perfectly decent people are capable of doing absolutely horrible things. And it's not because they're bad people, it's because of a variety of forces that operate in organizations that can oftentimes twist or suppress our own moral intuitions, whether that's authority, whether that's the particular role that we believe we're supposed to play in organizations, whether that's peer pressure, whether that's other forms of rationalizations that allow us to get into routines that are fundamentally wrong behavior.
All right, 11:40 here on the wake-up call as Professor Andy Wicks from the Olson Center for Applied Ethics at the Darden School tells a rather disturbing story. Professor Wicks, hang on with me for just a moment, okay?
Yeah.
It is 11:40 on the wake-up call as we talk about ethics with folks from the Practical Ethics Institute here at the UVA and Andy Wicks from the Darden School.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call, brought to you by the Markins of Tiger Fuel and by The Hook, an innovative weekly on newsstands every Thursday. Now here's Rick with what you can find in this week's Hook.
Oh, it's The Hook's annual manual. Look at our area government, culture, and real estate. Pages and pages of what to know, where to look, and how it works. Then check out a few celebrities in our town and consumer tips for those of you who are not. Let me think. Bob Wade's Auto World in Harrisonburg. They feature the all-new 2009 Forester and the Bob Wade Subaru Loaner Car for Life program. There's something for everyone at Bob Wade Subaru on the Route 11 Motor Mile in Harrisonburg. For more information, it's bobwadeautoworld.com. For those of you who are wondering, Piedmont Virginia Community College's fall semester registration going on right now. At PVCC, you can prepare for a technology or healthcare career in just 2 years. Classes begin on August 25th. You can get more information and register online at pvcc.edu. You can use them in the phone. Check it out at the phone book. Opportunity, access, excellence. Piedmont Virginia Community College. You know, I've been telling you about the underwriters, but we also want to thank the people. WNRN thanks Kathy Hinchy, Roy Huta, and Tatiana Patton for contributing to the fund drive this past spring. It's because of people like them that we're on the air every Sunday, and also because of program underwriters like the ones you hear from this hour, and Central Battery and Mona Lena Pasa. So stay tuned. Tell a friend about other programming you enjoy, and be sure to support us in the upcoming fall fund drive. All right, back with our guest, Professor Jim Childress, Professor Ruth Gar Bernheim, and Professor Andrew Wicks. Professor Wicks, you're still there?
I am.
Okay, I have to say you disturbed me for a minute there.
Good.
Because you're telling this tale about people who are willing to go so high, I guess effectively electrocuting somewhere, and you said that they were good people doing bad things.
Yeah.
What makes you say, how do you check to see that they are good people before they do this? I mean, I can see where everyone is surprised that they went beyond the, and I'm sure I screwed up the number, 1,500 volt or 150 volt.
Yeah.
But how did you know coming in that you had good people? Or the percentage out there was a certain percentage of people who, you know, I think you said one in 1,000. How did you know that that was the average or expectation?
Well, the reason I say that is, Milgram did psychological profiles on people that he used at the experiments to try to make sure that he didn't attract people that we would describe as psychologically having problems. But also the experiments were replicated in a number of different countries, a number of different scenarios, and the results are among the most robust in the psychology literature. So these are pretty well established. And, you know, you see other related experiments that reinforce this idea of the moral blinders or the fragility of our moral sensibilities that we think are so robust and so strong. There was a study that was done looking at seminary students, And the experiment that they did was they asked these seminary students to give a sermon on the parable of the Good Samaritan, the story that someone stops and helps somebody else in need. Well, they set the experiment up such that these seminary students going to give this sermon are made to be late. They have to rush to get to the chapel where they're going to give the sermon. And in order to get to the chapel, they have to walk past a person who is clearly, clearly in need, and in some cases literally have to step over them. The question is, how many of the seminary students stopped to help the person in need? And it was 1 in 3. 2/3 of the people continued to go on, did not stop to help, made it on time to give their sermon.
Well, fortunately for us, they're already at the church hour. 11:45 on the wake-up call as we talk about ethics here with three area professors at the University of Virginia. Professor Childress Ruth, you know, I should have asked this. Is it Professor Bernheim or Professor Gare Bernheim?
I go by anything. So
okay. Well, that's nice. the two of you with the things that Andrew Wicks has brought up, I'm curious as to how that works in, because, Ruth, you mentioned sort of getting everyone from different major fields together, right? Business, mm-hmm. Medical, and legal. To sort of get together and, I guess, bring in questions from how it applies to each of them,
right?
Topic.
Let me just respond to Andy's more recent the study he just mentioned and see how it fits in with what we were talking about earlier. So here are these good people. So you were looking to make sure that they were good people. So we would presume that seminarians at least are good people. They are walking along with their blinders on, because they have something to do. They have promised something. They have an obligation. And they're walking along, and they see something that they have to respond to quickly. They don't have time because they're rushed, like we all are in our normal life. And they have pulls in different directions. But their primary pull in the front of their mind at that point is to accomplish their goal, which is they made a promise and they're going to keep it. Well, promise keeping within our professional roles and our family and our personal life, that's a highly valued sort of intuition that we have. Because why? The foundation of our relationships is based on your word and your integrity and can you believe it and trust. So here is this sort of sleepy seminarian walking down with a pull in one direction and not realizing the significance in that moment of the pull in the other direction, which all of us would say upon reflection was much greater. In fact, it's the same for all of us. It just makes it the point a little more pointed when it is a seminarian who's supposed to be living their life for others. Okay, so, but that's an example of what happens to all of us in everyday life and why we are encouraged to find ways to pull back, to see when we're being pulled, and we don't even realize it because we're in a rush to get on with our sort of the primary or thing most in front of our minds. And so as Andy was suggesting, whether it's Enron or whether it's, public policy, we as a group, a society can get caught up in these questions and not realize with their current sort of attention being pulled in one direction, what are the other values at stake that we're not even giving sort of full weight to as we should? So it's a matter of attention and setting up a way of thinking about things in our everyday life and our professional lives that we say, wait a minute, we have to give time to pull back. And we have to figure out a way to recognize the tensions, give weight and give reasons to ourselves and others about why in any situation we should give weight to this and not that. So the seminarians, if you had said, stop, wait, take a deep breath, do some ethical reflection here now, they didn't have time. They might have pulled back and said, okay, my promise to this person in this situation wasn't as great as the need of this person in front of me. But that's the story of life, isn't it? That we're all hurrying through, you know, in any given moment, not very reflective.
You have a question on the table for Ruth that we'll want to come back to in a moment about involving the people from different parties. Let me just pick up on both her and Andy's discussion to say that basically what we're all about is trying to create and maintain the conditions of responsible action and thus of trust. And we do that in part by thinking through, trying to highlight the moral frameworks involving a variety of principles and values, being sure to call attention to those, trying to get people to incorporate those in the way they approach life, so that they'll be able to address difficult situations on the fly without making the wrong decision. But we're also interested, as Andy emphasized, in developing structures, organizational structures and cultures that can help support individuals in the decisions that they should be making along certain lines. And finally, we're interested in trying to develop individual character. So all those are aspects of what we're about, and at any one time we may emphasize one or the other.
All right, let me do this real quick before we keep jumping in to the next, because I do have that question, and I am looking for the answer. Drew Thompson is in the studio listening to the topic. He's here because he has Les Temps Perdue up next. If French isn't your thing at WNRN, that means The Time's Gone By, which is 80s and 90s alternative music. Tune in for it at noon. Les Temps Perdue, brought to you in part by Plan 9 Music. And you know another reason that we're here for the wake-up call on Sundays? Support from Rita's Italian Ice of Charlottesville. Italian ice and custard made fresh daily with real fruit. Every day brings a new selection of flavors at Rita's. Rita's Italian Ice, 1509 University Avenue near the UVA grounds. That's Rita's Italian Ice here in Charlottesville, 434-244-7482. Rita's Italian Ice, thanks for joining in. 11:51 here on the wake-up call. As we finish up our hour, the last 10 minutes here, talking about practical ethics, we have Andy Wicks from Center for Applied Ethics at the Darden School. He's on the phone. Ruth Gare Bernheim and Professor Jim Childress in the studio from the Institute for Practical Ethics and Public Life. Now, Ruth, I tossed that question out because you mentioned it earlier about getting the sort of mixed career people together to talk about something. And what sort of feedback do you get? You talked about doing it so that they could, I guess, see it and have conversations with themselves about and I want to come back because we still have a big topic here that I want to talk about with big mass casualty situations here. And I'll save that for just the last few minutes. But some of the topics that we have brought up, and so you have people from different careers sit down and talk about how it may affect them and what's going to go on or what they see in it. But what sort of feedback do you get afterwards, after the conversation takes place?
Well, we get very strong feedback about how these conversations made a big impact in how they think about ethics and the right thing to do. And why? Because we are all situated in a certain mindset and time, and being able to hear through the eyes and lenses of others what the context, what the big values and tensions are in this situation helps us see things differently. We might be missing important considerations about what's the ethical or right thing to do because we are within our own context. And so when business people and law students and the medical students come together in our session, and can Andy still weigh in on this? Is he still on the...
Yeah, great.
Andy and I have been teaching this course for a number of years together, so I'd love him to weigh in on this. I think that they have been made to wake up, if you might say, that the tensions that they have in their professional life, whether it's medicine or law, are common across professions, and they are able to see those tensions differently when they're not the ones who are the decision maker. So it's easy to see how wrong the people were in Enron, right? It's easy for medical people to, less easy for medical people to see what is so clearly wrong within their own profession until they hear reflection back. And so a lot of what we talk about in ethics is You need to go out, even if it's imaginatively in your own head, to give, to weigh all the reasons for all the actions you could take here. I'm pulled in so many different directions. What are the reasons for acting one way or another? And when you make the case to others, particularly who have a different lens, whether from a different profession, well, sometimes they give you feedback that you hadn't thought of. They help you see more clearly the values at stake or the contextual issues that you might not see are that as important as they are. Andy, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right, and it goes back to something you mentioned earlier, which is the importance of context. And I think we tend to operate in our comfort zone with our colleagues and our institutional setting all kind of nice and tidy, and it's when we talk to outsiders, people who have a very different perspective, who may have a whole different profession and state of mind and set of values that they can bring to the same set of questions, that I start to look at things a little bit differently. And I think that's the real rich spot for that conversation.
It was really interesting.
I think that students from each of those different professions have some embedded assumptions about what does a doctor think like, what does a lawyer think like, what does a business student think like. And I think one of the things that all the students find is that their peers and the assumptions they have about them are almost always not right. And they learn a lot about the mindset and the perspective of their peers. And they find that very, very rich.
If I could add something there. This is, I think, for both Andy's work at Darden and also what we're trying to do at the Institute of Practical Ethics and Public Life. It's necessary to have interdisciplinary, interprofessional exchanges because we do see things differently as a result of the encounter with the other who finds what we are proposing or what we're assuming to be quite odd. So this is a part of the, I think, creative tension that can emerge from appropriate exchanges, often looking at common problems, or in the case of the seminar that Ruth and Andy have taught, looking at literature. And I've heard reports from students in similar seminars that when they read a particular work, say a work of fiction, with members of their own professional group, they came at the issues in a certain way. But when they read that same work in this sort of seminar involving students across different professions, they saw things quite differently. That is part of what we're about.
All right, Professor Wicks, I'm going to let you go. Professor Andrew Wicks, Olson Center for Applied Ethics at the Darden School here at the University of Virginia. Professor, thanks so much for joining in, and travel safely, please.
Thank you very much.
All right. Professor Andrew Wicks here with us on air. 11:57 on the wake-up call. Let me remind you, and just in case you didn't know, this is WNRN Charlottesville and WNRS FM Sweetbriar Amherst Lynchburg. Drew Thompson will be up with Les Temps-Perdue in just a moment. I don't guess we're going to get into the topic really at hand. Ruth, I'm really sorry because I think this was a key factor for you. But let me toss it out there because I'd hope that there's a way for the average citizen to participate in this. And one of the things was the allocation of scarce resources in a mass casualty situation, whether that's pandemic influenza, a bioterrorist attack, et cetera, and what the average citizen may gain or lose when there's not enough to go around. Is it a way for me to write in and learn more about the discussion that's going on and make my own contribution to the discussion?
Absolutely. Do you know, this is part of the conversation we've been having the whole morning about pulling back together and reflecting, all things considered, when we have scarce resources, what is the right thing to do? Because we have laws that lay out authority and prepare us for quarantine and certain legal remedies, but there are still these questions in the gray area. So in ethics, we need opportunities for deliberating together to come up with the answers. What should we do? And communities across the country now are grappling with that and setting up citizen forums or other meetings and where students and faculty and community members and public health officials can all come together and reflect on the tensions.
So how do they do that? Because we're down to our
last
few
minute
seconds or so.
We don't have any set up this minute, but Dr. Lillian Peek, who is head of our local health department, is working on this with physician leaders and community leaders in the community. And at the state level, our state health department has a pandemic advisory flu committee that's open to the public, and it meets probably once a month.
Because what we're talking about is flu for everyone and not enough ways to fix it. And so some people are going to get left out. Correct?
Well, I wouldn't say some people are going to be left out. I would say they're tough decisions where some people are going to have be prioritized because of what we view as their the need to have them healthy, so to keep the whole community going, so that everyone will have an appropriate shot at getting the medicines. And we just have to figure out the right priority scheme for the good of the community, because every individual has an interest and stake in making sure the good of the community is taken into account and survives.
Well, I think we need to have you folks back so we can talk about this once again, because we didn't finish the hour as far as I was concerned.
We just started this
topic.
It's such an topic. Important one. Yeah.
And I think that we will, if you're willing to come back later on, we'll do this again.
That would be great with some of our public health people.
Excellent. So that finishes our hour on practical ethics. Professor Jim Childress, Professor Ruth Garrett Bernheim, thank you so much for coming in today. Andrew Wicks by phone from California, I think. All right. Next week, boys and girls, we'll be talking with a university professor who specializes in China about what's going on in China and along with the Olympics. Thank you so much.
This has been your Sunday morning wake-up call on WNRN. The wake-up call is brought to you by The Hook, an innovative weekly from the people who really know the news on Newsstands Thursday. And by Tiger Fuel, serving the Charlottesville area with home heating oil and propane, Exxon gasoline, and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management, staff, or board of WNRN. You can contact Rick at abstractme@aol.com or at wnrn.org. The wake-up call is produced by Michael Strickland. Tune in again next Sunday morning at 11 for the wake-up call, only on WNRN.